Social determinants, a legacy of distrust and inequities have all been challenges for people of color in the delivery of healthcare. And these factors have translated to the administration of COVID-19 vaccines. A recent study published in JAMA demonstrated Black and Latinx challenges surrounding COVID-19 vaccines. Investigators in New Haven, Connecticut created a focus group that interviewed Black and Latinx participants to learn and understand factors associated with facilitating and obstructing COVID-19 vaccine access. Participants described three major themes that may represent facilitators and barriers to COVID-19 vaccinations. One was the pervasive mistreatment of Black and Latinx communities and associated distrust. Two, informing trust via trusted messengers and messages. And three, addressing structural barriers to vaccination access. These issues lead to vaccine inequities, and Contagion wanted to discuss this important health issue with our latest podcast episode. Today's podcast features an interview with Dr. Jacinda Abdul-Mutakabir. She is the Assistant Professor of Pharmacy Practice at Loma Linda University School of Pharmacy. She was a project leader involved in getting greater COVID-19 vaccine participation among the local Black community in San Bernardino County, California. From her work, she developed a poster, The Utility of Community and Academic Partnerships in Promoting the Equitable Delivery of COVID-19 vaccines in Black communities. She presented the poster at last year's ID Week. Listen in on her experience on the project and her commentary on vaccine equity. I want to first begin with asking, when you hear the term vaccine inequity, what does that mean to you?
So when I think about vaccine inequity, and thank you, John, for that question, I think about, you know, equality versus equity, because I know oftentimes we hear equality and equity being used interchangeably, and they're not interchangeable terms. So when I think about equality, it's more so, okay, everyone can technically get the vaccine. So you hear, you know, the Biden-Harris administration, they say, you know, we have X amount of doses, meaning that everybody can have them. We have enough for every single person in the United States, which is true. They do. But then when you think about, you know, how is it that everyone is supposed to receive these vaccines? Are they in their community? Have they been allocated to primarily racially and ethnically minoritized communities? Do employers give time off if individuals were to have side effects from the vaccine? Are individuals able to go after their essential working hours to get the vaccine? When I think about racially and ethnically minoritized individuals, I think about the fact that they usually occupy those essential worker roles. And when they do, they're nervous about getting sick, you know, after the vaccines. They're nervous about if they receive a dose of the vaccine, not feeling well, because they're like, hey, I can't afford to be off this day of work. I might lose my job. There may be somebody else, you know, waiting in the ranks to take my job. I may not be able to support my family. Maybe I'm paid hourly. I can't afford an 8-hour loss of wages. So those are things that I think about when I think about equity. So not only the vaccines being available to them, because they are. We have enough doses for every single person to receive like 4 or 5. You know, let's be honest about what we have here in the United States. We are a very privileged nation in that way. But when we think about the vaccines and whether people are actually able to have the vaccines, to reach the vaccines, to be in a position where they are comfortable being vaccinated, that's not necessarily the case. And when I think about even trustworthy messengers, so having access to adequate education that discusses the vaccines, that disputes misinformation, that builds a trusting relationship between those of racially and ethnically minoritized groups that have been previously mistreated and placed in uncomfortable situations due to systemic racism, do they have access to those individuals that they can trust to receive the vaccines from? That's a piece of equity we don't think about. That's a piece of what equality we don't think about, because when you think about, you know, The majority of individuals, they have providers that look like them. They don't think about the fact that, you know, oh, I'm nervous about receiving this vaccine. I've heard about the mistreatment of people that look like me at the hands of the United States healthcare system. Maybe if I had someone that looked like me, I could be more trusting of this, or someone that looked like me to translate the data and the information, I could be more trusting of receiving the vaccine. That's a piece of equality we don't think about. That's equity, though. That's healthcare being fitted to the needs of those individuals that will, that also need to benefit from it. So I think that there are many different aspects of that. And when I think about vaccine inequity or vaccine equity, I think about each of those aspects, and are those being optimized, and are those placed at the forefront of vaccine distribution, allocation, access, and things of that sort.
Some really good points there, and some food for thought, absolutely, because I think we all bring our own perspective, and sometimes we may be a little short-sighted in thinking about other people's challenges. And you really make some good points there. And in thinking about that, what are some of the biggest factors and social determinants associated with vaccine inequities?
I think when I think about the social determinant of health inequities that are associated, when I think about vaccine inequities and things of that, I think about education, as I mentioned. So being able to have those individuals that can translate the information and the data, that can thwart the misinformation and disinformation. Once again, like I said, that stems from the mistrust based upon systemic racism. I don't want to place the fault with my racially and ethnically minoritized communities. I want to place racism at the forefront of that. When I think about income, I think in a roundabout way, that becomes a social determinant of health that we need to think about, because when you think about income, like I said, the loss of wages, a lot of individuals can't afford the loss of wages of not feeling well after a vaccination. So then that income then becomes a factor, because then that's what they're thinking about. Will I have enough money to support, you know, myself, my family? I think about work. So I think about, once again, being able to have that time off of work. But then I think about the fact that racially and ethnically minoritized individuals usually are our essential workers, meaning they work that 9 to 5. So when you think about normal hours that pharmacies operate, normal hours that primary care provider offices are open, it's usually from 9 to 5. So now they're placed in this position where they can't commit to those appointments because they have to go to work. They work during those time periods. I think about unemployment. That's a big fear. You know, going to get vaccinated, like I said, if you're not feeling well, you have to miss that time. If you want to go for a vaccine appointment, then maybe it's that thought in your mind of, well, I can't, you know, take an hour and a half to go to the nearest pharmacy, because we know there's not always a place that is easily accessible to receive the vaccine. So maybe they have to drive a ways out. They don't have that time to allot in their work schedule. I think about the access. So actually having those vaccines allocated and accessible in those communities, as I talked about, you know, there are times in urban communities and remote communities in which people of racially and ethnically minoritized groups live. There may not be a pharmacy around. There may not be a primary care provider around. So where are they supposed to go to get those vaccines? And I know this seems far-fetched for the majority of individuals, but I've gone to these communities where they have flocked to our vaccination clinics because they did not have any other access. So they did not know if they would be able to get vaccinated because they had not seen the vaccines in their community. I think about transportation. When we think about these major vaccine clinic sites, when we think about the pharmacies and things of that sort, people need cars to get there. You know, they need transport systems, big transport systems. So subways, buses, things of that. But when we think about those areas that have the vaccine clinics, they're not easily accessible by these larger modes of transportation, those modes of transportation that usually people of racially and ethnically minoritized groups are more likely to have to occupy. So I think about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you make some really good points. I mean, whether it's work or access or transportation, it's really important to, you know, first point out and identify the issue. And there's a lot of complexity to it. And I think equally as important is when we're thinking about identifying these issues, it's then looking at the other side of it, which is finding strategies to combat the problem. And last year, you were involved in a COVID-19 vaccine drive at Loma Linda University, which involved local Black churches. Can you offer some insights on that drive, including how it came to be and some of the results from the vaccine drive?
Absolutely. So, so we did a COVID-19 vaccine clinic. So at Loma Linda, we have the largest mass vaccine clinic site in San Bernardino County. So San Bernardino County is one of the largest counties with over 1 million inhabitants in Southern California. So we had the largest site. And so we were vaccinating about 1,000 to 2,000 individuals every single day. And towards the second to third month of our vaccine clinic, we noticed that we were seeing just inequity or disproportionate amount of Black vaccinees. So meaning we had about 20% of Black individuals hospitalized. And this was something that paralleled what we saw in San Bernardino County and in Southern California as a whole. So we were seeing less Black individuals being vaccinated, but we were seeing more of them in the hospital than what they represented, of course, in the Southern California demographics or California demographics. So they represent about 8% of the inhabitants of California and 8% of Southern California, and then about that much here in San Bernardino. But in our mass vaccine clinic site, we only had 3% of our vaccinees that were Black. So once again, you know, a disproportion, inequity, this, that. And we knew that it would be important to increase, and we knew that we needed to develop concentrated efforts to go ahead and increase the number of Black vaccinees, because we were seeing that disproportion. We wanted to overrepresent the previously underrepresented in our mass vaccine clinic site. So with that, we thought about what would be important for this. What are the, like we talked about previously, social determinant of health inequities that we are likely seeing that are translating to this distribution that's not necessarily representative of the amount of individuals that are hospitalized due to COVID. So with that, we developed a three-tiered approach. So that included the engagement of Black faith leaders. And then that included the information of COVID-19 and of the vaccines being delivered by a Black pharmacist, Black psychologist. We have a Latino assistant vice president for community engagement, and all three of us take part in the education endeavor. So the representation of individuals that look like the community in which we wanted to target. And then we then place vaccination clinics right there in the community, so easily accessible by transportation. But not only that, these clinics were low barrier. So we use paper-based registration, so people can walk up and they can register right there. They don't have to rely on the internet. So once again, not influenced by that digital divide that we see among racially and ethnically minoritized groups. So we use all of those factors to go ahead and do our vaccine clinics. So with that being said, we were able to see a very necessary overrepresentation. So what we wanted to see in our mass vaccine clinic site, we had about 3% of individuals that were Black. In our community vaccination clinic effort, we had 84.2% of the individuals that were vaccinated that were Black. So that was the difference that we wanted to see. And that was the difference from going from a mass vaccination clinic site that was not easily accessible, that was not targeted to deliver the necessary education to build trustworthy relationships, that was not leveraging the previously developed relationships that we have with faith leaders. We then went ahead and we put all of those things into play, and we were able to see the success of that. So as we continued with these clinics, we then saw different social determinant of health inequities that were really brought to light. The one being, you know, the timing of the clinics. So during the clinics on actual like work days, we were like, huh, that maybe is not a good deal. Maybe we should do the weekends. So we started doing Sundays. We do Saturdays. Currently, we do Sundays for our booster clinics, because equity is also going back into those communities and delivering the booster doses. So that's what we're focused on right now. And we said, okay, maybe weekdays aren't the best. Maybe Fridays aren't the best. Let's go for the weekend. And then we thought about the timing, huh? Maybe 9 to 5 isn't good for everybody. Let's do some clinics from 4 to 7 to allow those individuals that get off work, you know, a little bit later to go ahead and get vaccinated. we said, hey, maybe people won't come to where we are stationed for the vaccine clinic. Let's go around to these neighborhoods and knock on their houses, knock on their doors and see if they want to get vaccinated. And then we actually started knocking on doors with small strike teams of pharmacy, medicine, and dentistry students and vaccinating people right inside their homes. So I think it's important that as we look at inequities, as we focus on equity, we also look at ways and we also continue to recalibrate, readjust our approach to delivering these equitable practices for vaccination.
Yeah, it sounds like the drive itself was a really well thought out, had a lot of elements to it. And, you know, one of the things you're talking about is the timing of the clinics, I think, which is, you know, a really good segue into my next question, which is, you know, thinking about some of the important takeaway lessons from that experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that the important takeaway for me mm-hmm. was to always remember that not every approach is best for every single racially and ethnically minoritized group. And I think that when we think about, you know, minoritized individuals, it's often like, okay, we need to do all of these things, you know, to increase vaccinations in these areas. But I think that the beauty of what we've been able to do at Loma Linda is to take that step back and say, okay, in the Black community, we need trustworthy messaging. We need access. We need to put, you know, extra attention on these several things to make sure that we are adequately doing exactly what it is that we wanted to do. And then we look at the Latino community. We like, okay, we need to build our trustworthy relationships. Absolutely. But we really want to focus on access. We want to make sure that we're able to put these vaccines there in that community. And I think being able to actually talk amongst ourselves and say, hey, this is what I'm seeing here. This is what I'm seeing there. And, I think more importantly for me, being a young clinician, is actually being able to see how important trust is, with the community, how important it is and how long it goes, how long the trusting relationship goes, the way how it can change the way that so many different people view healthcare. And I think a testament to that is we actually received an award from the community. So myself and those individuals that were involved in our vaccination effort, we recently received an award from the community because they were thankful for what we did. But then after we received the award, it wasn't the award that was powerful. I'm very thankful to them for that. But what was so powerful to me was what the individuals from the church said when I walked down from the stage. And this man looked at me with tears in his eyes. He said, you don't know how many lives that you saved. And he said, not even just in the clinic, you know, even he said, when I go and I tell people about the clinic, I then send them, you know, to your videos because I have videos on YouTube so I can continue to deliver education, even for people that are not able to attend the educational webinars that we have. We have a webinar before each clinic. But for those people that don't attend, I have a YouTube and I have a video uploaded there of exactly the same information. And he told me, he said, well, then I just send them to your video and I have them listen, you know, to what it is that you say. But he was like, I've had pastors that have attended so many of the webinars that they're actually able to regurgitate every single thing that I say. And then they're able to stand on their pulpit and give that information to their parishioners, to their community members, to the people that trust them. So through the trust that they have in me, we're able to save not only the lives that we see, but the lives of so many other people. And I think that's important. That's the big takeaway, is the trust that people have in you, the trust that people then have in the healthcare system. Not only it goes so much further than what we can see. And I think I've learned about the importance of, I talk about equity, but the importance of seeing it all the way through. So in my head, I thought about, you know, before we decided to go back out with our vaccine effort, I said, we got to go give these people boosters. Like the minute that the booster vaccines become available, we have to go back. And we actually did clinics where we exclusively vaccinated individuals with only the J&J vaccine. And we went back and we actually called up every single number that we had and told them that they were due for a booster when the evidence and information came out that you should get the J&J, you should get a booster after 2 months. We called them and told them they were due, but we also had a clinic and we allowed for them to come to, they were our priority at that clinic to get their booster doses. So that showed me like the full circle, but how committed you have to be to seeing equity all the way through.
Absolutely. And that's amazing. I love the feedback that you'd received about that and the local award. Congrats on that. I think one of the things about that stands out to me is the whole idea or the concept of seeing it all the way through. And you make a really good point about the boosters, which, you know, it's very challenging to get people to get the first round of vaccines. And, you know, there's a lot more to not only protecting yourself from the actual virus, but one of the things you've said in the past is that COVID-19 vaccines can help avoid hospital stays and health issues beyond COVID-19. Can you explain how this helps with antimicrobial resistance?
Absolutely. And thank you, John. This is what I'm newly dedicating myself to. But I think when we think about vaccine preventable diseases, I always think about the fact this was at the forefront of my mind as I went forth and did the vaccine clinics, was that at the end of the day, racial and ethnically minoritized groups are perpetually behind in terms of being vaccinated against these vaccine preventable respiratory diseases. We think about the flu, individuals that are Black, Latino, Native American for the last 10 years have been less likely to receive the influenza vaccine, have been more represented in hospitalizations, have been more represented in deaths. When I think about the flu, and I think about myself when I was a very young pharmacist on my rotational experiences, I remember seeing so many co-infections with resistant bacteria. And I would think to myself, how does this happen? How does this occur? And why are so many people here with these co-infections? And why are so many of them, you know, Black individuals, Latino individuals? But then it made so much sense, you know, as I began to learn more and more about infectious diseases, as I've now done these vaccine clinics, is if you don't necessarily just can have to worry about contracting the virus and then, you know, passing away from that virus. You have to think about the fact, well, if you get the virus, then if you end up in the hospital, meaning you get a severe presentation of this virus, you end up in the hospital, you're there. When you're in the hospital, we all know as infectious diseases professionals that the longer you're there, the more apt you are to being infected with bad bacteria. So many bad bacteria, so many resistant bacteria exist in those hospitals. And I think about just the ability for secondary or co-infections and how that can happen for people. The more severely ill that they are, the more likely they are to have to be ventilated, and then the longer duration that they have to stay. And then I think about, well, how can we get out ahead of this? Well, we can make sure that we push the importance of vaccines, that we educate on the importance of vaccines, that we build these trustworthy relationships. Because then if they get vaccinated against these respiratory preventable diseases, then they're less likely to end up in the hospital. They're less likely to contract these resistant bacteria. And then I think about, even when they get these resistant bacteria, do these areas that are heavily occupied by racially and ethnically minoritized groups, do they have the research necessary to know which combination therapies can be used adequately to overcome this resistance? Do they have the novel therapeutics that are developed to overcome these resistant bacteria? Do they have the rapid diagnostics to be able to know the minute that the culture becomes positive for that resistant bacteria? The answer is no. But what they do have, what they are able to have, are vaccines. And that can assist us in our fight against antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, and you know, you make a really good point about looking at influenza and the idea of routine vaccinations. And finally, I just wanted to get your sense of things. You know, you referenced the story, you were talking about when you were a younger pharmacist and seeing a lot of co-infections and people, you know, and looking at the influenza vaccine and thinking about routine vaccines in general. Do you think we're getting better in terms of routine vaccine equity, or do you think we still have a long way to go?
I think that there are allies to look for the positives. I think that there are mechanisms that show, I think that it's becoming more visual, the things that we need to become better. So I do see, you know, tinges of light at the end of the tunnel. But I think that at the end of the day, the most important thing, and this is something that I say all the time, is we have to make vaccine equity a priority. And the minute that it becomes a priority for us as clinicians, for us as, you know, the other officials that govern how vaccines are allocated and provided, the minute it becomes a priority is the minute that we see the difference. But then when we think about vaccine equity, we can't just think about it nationally. We have to think about it internationally, because we have to think about the fact that people travel, and then you end up with these other viruses, bacteria. I mean, look at the position we're in right now with COVID. And that ends up being something that can once again cause a pandemic or severe illnesses in other regions. So I think when we think about vaccine equity, I think that nationally we have very key things that can assist us in one, making vaccine equity a priority and governing how it is that we navigate with making sure that we can allocate and provide access and educate and build trustworthy relationships. But I think we also have to advocate and really stress the importance of global vaccine equity and how that ultimately looks for how it is that we, you know, coexist.
As you can hear from Jacinda's commentary, there are some deep-seated issues that are preventing some from getting vaccines. Vaccine equity can go a long way in not only protecting people against severe COVID-19 and hospitalization, but can prevent other potential healthcare-associated infections. If you are interested in this topic, listen to my colleague Nina Cousins' podcast and her vaccine equity interview with Dr. Leonard Freeland. We would like to hear from you and get your feedback. So please feel free to email Nina at ncosdon@mjhlifesciences.com. Thank you for listening.